just didn't care. From behind them came a steady beating sound, growing louder. Two transport helicopters were coming in from the north, almost skimming the TR-90 treetops.
They better watch out for the Doma. They'll crash like the airplane, Nori cried.
The copters did not crash. They reached the edge of safe airspace some 2 miles distant, then began to descend. 21. Cox had told Barbie of an old supply road that ran from the McCoy Orchard to the TR-90 border, and said it still looked passable. Barbie, Rusty, Romy, Julia, and Pete Freeman drove along it around 7:30 Friday morning. Barbie trusted Cox, but not necessarily pictures of an old truck track snapped from 200 miles up, so they'd taken the van Ernie Calvert had stolen from Big Jim Rennie's lot. That one, Barbie was perfectly willing to lose if it got stuck. Pete was sans camera. His digital Nikon had ceased to work when he got close to the box. "ETs don't like the paparazzi, Broha," Barbie said. He thought it was a moderately funny line, but when it came to his camera, Pete had no sense of humor. The ex-phone company van made it to the dome, and now the five of them watched as the two huge CH-47s waddled toward an overgrown hayfield on the TR-90 side. The road continued over there, and the Chinook's rotors churned dust up in great clouds. Barbie and the others shielded their eyes, but that was only instinct and unnecessary. The dust billowed as far as the dome, and then rolled off to either side. The choppers alit with the slow decorum of overweight ladies settling into theater seats a tad too small for their bottoms. Barbie heard the hellish scree of metal on a protruding rock, and the copter to the left lumbered 30 yards sideways before trying again. A figure jumped from the open bay of the first one and strode through the cloud of disturbed grit, waving it impatiently aside. Barbie would have known that no-nonsense little fireplug anywhere. Cox slowed as he approached and put out one hand like a blind man feeling for obstructions in the dark. Then he was wiping away the dust on his side.
"It's good to see you breathing free air, Colonel Barbara."
"Yes, sir." Cox shifted his gaze.
"Hello, Mrs. Shumway. Hello, you other friends of Barbara. I want to hear everything, but it will have to be quick. I've got a little dog and pony show going on across town, and I want to be there for it."
Cox jerked a thumb over his shoulder where the unloading had already begun. Dozens of Air Max fans with attached generators. They were big ones, Barbie saw with relief. The kind used for drying tennis courts and racetrack pit areas after heavy rains. Each was bolted to its own two-wheeled dolly platform. The Jennies looked 20 horsepower at most. He hoped that would be enough.
"First, I want you to tell me those aren't going to be necessary."
"I don't know for sure," Barbie said, "but I'm afraid they might be. You may want to get some more on the 119 side, where the townspeople are meeting their relatives."
"By tonight," Cox said, "that's the best we can do."
"Take some of these," Rusty said. "If we need them all, we'll be in extremely deep shit anyway."
"Can't happen, son. Maybe if we could cut across Chester's Mill airspace, but if we could do that, there wouldn't be a problem, would there? And putting a line of generator-powered industrial fans where the visitors are going to be kind of defeats the purpose. Nobody would be able to hear anything. Those babies are loud." He glanced at his watch. "Now, how much can you tell me in 15 minutes?
Halloween comes early. 1. At 7:45, Linda Everett's almost new Honda Odyssey Green rolled up to the loading dock behind Burpee's department store. Thirst was riding shotgun. The kids, far too silent for children setting off on an adventure, were in the back seat. Aiden was hugging Audrey's head. Audie, probably sensing the little boy's distress, bore this patiently. Linda's shoulder was still throbbing in spite of 3 aspirin, and she couldn't get Carter Thibodeau's face out of her mind. Or his smell. A mixture of sweat and cologne. She kept expecting him to pull up behind her in one of the town police cars, blocking their retreat. "The next load I shoot is going straight up the old wazoo, whether the kids are watching or not." He'd do it, too, he would. And while she couldn't get all the way out of town, she was wild to put as much distance between herself and Rennie's new man Friday as possible.
"Grab a whole roll in the metal snips," she told Thurse. "They're under that milk box, Rusty told me."
Thurston had opened the door, but now he paused.
"I can't do that. What if somebody else needs them?"
She wasn't going to argue. She'd probably wind up screaming at him and scaring the children.
Whatever, just hurry up. This is like a box canyon.
As fast as I can.
Yet it seemed to take him forever to snip pieces of the lead roll, and she had to restrain herself from leaning out the window and asking if he had been born a prissy old lady or just grew into one.
Keep it shut.
He lost someone he loved last night.
Yes, and if they didn't hurry, she might lose everything.
There were already people on Main Street, heading out toward 119 and the Dinsmore Dairy Farm, intent on getting the best places. Linda jumped every time a police loudspeaker blared.
Cars are not allowed on the highway. Unless you are physically disabled, you must walk.
Thibodeau was smart, and he had sniffed something. What if he came back and saw that her van was gone? Would he look for it? Meanwhile, Thirst just kept snipping pieces of lead from the roofing roll. He turned, and she thought he was done, but he was only visually measuring the windshield. He started cutting again, whacking off another piece. Maybe he was actually trying to drive her mad. A silly idea, but once it had entered her mind, it wouldn't leave. She could still feel Thibodeau rubbing against her bottom, the tickle of his stubble, the fingers squeezing her breast. She told herself not to look at what he'd left on the seat of her jeans when she took them off, but she couldn't help it. The word that rose in her mind was mansplat, and she found herself in a short, grim struggle to keep her breakfast down, which also would have pleased him, if he had known. Sweat sprang out on her brow.
Mom?
Judy, right in her ear. Linda jumped and uttered a cry.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to jump you. Can I have something to eat?
Not now.
Why does that man keep loudspeakering?
Honey, I can't talk to you right now.
Are you bumming?
Yes, a little. Now, sit back.
Are we going to see Daddy?
Yes. Unless we get caught and I get raped in front of you.
Now, sit back.
Thirst was finally coming. Thank God for small favors. He appeared to be carrying enough cut squares and rectangles of lead to armor a tank.
See? That wasn't so bad. Aw, shit.
The kids giggled, the sound like rough flies sawing away at Linda's brain.
Quarter in the swear jar, Mr. Marshall,
Janelle said. Thirst was looking down, bemused. He had stuck the metal snips in his belt.
I'll just put these back under the milk box.
Linda snatched them before he could finish, restrained a momentary urge to bury them up to the handles in his narrow chest. Admirable restraint, she thought, and got out to put them away herself. As she did, a vehicle slid in behind the van, blocking access to West Street, the only way out of this cul-de-sac. 2. Atop Town Common Hill, just below the Y intersection where Highland Avenue split off from Main Street, Jim Rennie's Hummer sat idling. From below came the amplified exhortations for people to leave their cars and walk unless they were disabled. People were flowing down the sidewalks, many with packs on their backs. Big Jim eyed them with that species of long-suffering contempt which is felt only by caretakers who do their jobs not out of love, but out of duty. Going against the tide was Carter Thibodeau. He was striding in the middle of the street, every now and then shoving someone out of his way. He reached the Hummer, got in on the passenger side and armed sweat from his forehead.
Man, that AC feels good. Not hardly 8 in the morning, and it's got to be 75 degrees out there already. And the air smells like a frickin' ashtray. Excuse the language, boss.
What kind of luck did you have?
A bad kind. I talked to Officer Everett. Ex-Officer Everett. The others are in the breeze.
Does she know anything?
No, she hasn't heard from the doc.
And Weddington treated her like a mushroom, kept her in the dark and fed her shit.
You sure?
Yep. Her kids there with her?
Yep. The hippie, too. The one who straightened out your ticker. Plus the two kids, Junior and Frankie, found out at the pond.
Carter thought about this.
With his chick dead and her husband gone, him and Everett will probably be boinking each other's brains out by the end of the week. If you want me to take another run at her boss, I will.
Big Jim flicked a single finger up from the steering wheel to show that wouldn't be necessary. His attention was elsewhere.
Look at them, Carter. Carter couldn't very well help it. The foot traffic out of town was thickening every minute. Most of them will be at the dome by 9, and their cotton-picking relatives won't arrive until 10, at the earliest. By then, they'll be good and thirsty. By noon, the ones who didn't think to bring water will be drinking cow piddle out of Alden Dinsmore's pond. God love them. God must love them, because the majority are too dumb to work and too nervous to steal. Carter barked laughter. That's what we've got to deal with, Rennie said. The mob, the cotton-picking rabble. What do they want, Carter?
I don't know, boss.
Sure you do. They want food, opera, country music, and a warm bed to thump uglies in when the sun goes down, so they can make more just like them. And goodness me, here comes another member of the tribe.
It was Chief Randolph trudging up the hill and mopping his bright red face with a handkerchief. Big Jim was now in full lecture mode.
Our job, Carter, is to take care of them. We may not like it, we may not always think they're worth it. But it's the job God gave us. Only to do it, we have to take care of ourselves first. And that's why a good deal of fresh fruit and veg from Food City was stored in the town clerk's office 2 days ago. You didn't know that, did you? Well, that's all right. You're a step ahead of them, and I'm a step ahead of you, and that's how it's supposed to be. The lesson is simple. The Lord helps those that help themselves.
Yes, sir.
Randolph arrived. He was puffing. There were circles under his eyes, and he appeared to have lost weight. Big Jim pushed the button that ran down his window.
Step in, Chief. Grab yourself some AC.
And when Randolph started for the passenger seat, Big Jim added, Not there. Carter's sitting there. He smiled.
Get him back.
3. It wasn't a police car that had pulled up behind the Odyssey van. It was the hospital ambulance. Dougie Twitchell was at the wheel. Ginny Tomlinson was in the passenger seat with a sleeping baby in her lap. The rear doors opened and Gina Buffalino got out. She was still in her candy striper uniform. The girl who followed her, Harriet Bigelow, wore jeans and t-shirt that said U.S. Olympic Kissing Team. What? That seemed to be all Linda was capable of. Her heart was racing, the blood pounding so hard in her head that she seemed to feel her eardrums flapping. Twitch said,
Rusty called us and told us to get out to the orchard at Black Ridge. I didn't even know there was an orchard up there, but Ginny did, and... Linda? Honey, you're white as a ghost.
I'm okay,
Linda said, and realized she was on the verge of fainting. She pinched her earlobes, a trick Rusty had taught her a long time ago. Like many of his folk remedies, beating down Wens with the spine of a heavy book was another. It worked. When she spoke again, her voice seemed both nearer and somehow realer.
He told you to come here first?
Yes, to get some of that.
He pointed to the lead roll sitting on the loading dock.
Just to be on the safe side is what he said, but I'll need those snips.
Uncle Twitch!
Janelle cried and dashed into his arms.
What's up, Tiger Lily?
He hugged her, swung her, set her down. Janelle peered into the passenger window at the baby.
What's her name?
It's a he, Ginny said. His name's Little Walter.
Cool. Jenny,
get back in the van. We have to go, Linda said.
Thurse asked,
Who's mining the store, you guys?
Ginny looked embarrassed.
Nobody. But Rusty said not to worry unless there was somebody in need of constant care. Other than little Walter, there wasn't. So I grabbed the baby and we boogied. We might be able to go back later, Twitch says.
Somebody better be able to, Thurse said gloomily.
Gloom, Linda had noticed, seemed to be Thurston Marshall's default position.
3/4 of the town is hoofing it out, 119 to the dome. The air quality's bad, and it's going to be 85 by 10 o'clock, which will be about the time the visitor buses arrive. If Rennie and his cohorts have done anything about providing shelter, I haven't heard of it. There's apt to be a lot of sick people in Chester's Mill before sundown. With luck, only heat stroke and asthma, but there could be a few heart attacks as well.
Guys, maybe we should go back, Gina said. I feel like a rat deserting a sinking ship.
No,
Linda said so sharply that they all looked at her, even Audie.
Rusty said something bad is going to happen. It might not be today, but he said it might be. Get your lead for the ambulance windows and go. I don't dare wait around. One of Rennie's thugs came to see me this morning, and if he swings by the house and sees the van's gone...
Go on, go, Twitch said. I'll back up so you can get out. Don't bother with Main Street, it's already a mess.
Main Street past the cop shop?
Linda almost shuddered.
No thanks. Mom's taxi goes West Street up to Highland.
Twitch got in behind the wheel of the ambulance, and the two young nurse draftees got him back again, Gina giving Linda a final doubtful look over her shoulder. Linda paused, looking first at the sleeping, sweaty baby, then at Ginny.
Maybe you and Twitch can go back to the hospital tonight to see how things are there. Say you were on a call way the hell and gone out in Northchester, or something. Just whatever you do, don't mention anything about Black Ridge. No.
Easy to say now, Linda thought. You might not find dummying up so easy if Carter Thibodeau bends you over a sink. She pushed Audrey back, shut the slider, and got behind the wheel of the Odyssey Green.
Let's get out of here, Thirst said, climbing in beside her. I haven't been this paranoid since my off-the-pig days.
Good, she said, because perfect paranoia is perfect awareness.
She backed her van around the ambulance and started up West Street. 4.
Jim, Randolph said from the back seat of the Hummer, I've been thinking about this raid.
Have you now? Why don't you give us the benefit of your thinking, Peter?
I'm the chief of police. If it comes down to a choice between crowd control at Dinsmore's farm and leading a raid on a drug lab where there may be armed addicts guarding illegal substances, well, I know where my duty lies. Let's just say that.
Big Jim discovered he didn't want to argue the point. Arguing with fools was counterproductive. Randolph had no idea what sort of weapons might be stockpiled at the radio station. In truth, neither did Big Jim himself. There was no telling what Bushy might have put on the corporate tab. But at least he could imagine the worst, a mental feat of which this uniformed gas bag seemed incapable. And if something should happen to Randolph... Well, hadn't he already decided that Carter would be a more than adequate replacement?
All right, Pete, he said. Far be it from me to stand between you and your duty. You're the new OIC, with Fred Denton as your second. That satisfy you?
You're gosh damn right it does. Randolph puffed his chest.
He looked like a fat rooster about to crow. Big Jim, although not renowned for his sense of humor, had to stifle a laugh.
Then get down there to the PD and start putting together your crew. Town trucks, remember?
Correct. We strike at noon.
He shook a fist in the air.
Go in through the woods.
Now, Jim, I wanted to talk to you about that. It seems a little complicated. Those woods behind the station are pretty snarly. There'll be poison ivy and poison oak, which is even worse.
There's an access road, Big Jim said. He was reaching the end of his patience. I want you to use it. Hit them on their blind side.
But...
A bullet in the head would be much worse than poison ivy. Nice talking to you, Pete. Glad to see you're so...
But what was he so? Pompous? Ridiculous? Idiotic?
So totally gung-ho, Carter said.
Thank you, Carter. My thought exactly. Pete, tell Henry Morrison he's now in charge of crowd control out on 119 and use the access road.
I really think...
Carter... Get the door for him. 5.
Oh, my God, Linda said, and swerved the van to the left.
It bumped up over the curb not 100 yards from where Main and Highland intersected. All three girls laughed at the bump, but poor little Aiden only looked scared and grabbed the long-suffering Audrey's head once more.
What? Thirst snapped. What?
She parked on someone's lawn behind a tree. It was a good-sized oak, but the van was big, too, and the oak had lost most of its listless leaves. She wanted to believe they were hidden, but couldn't.
That's Jim Rennie's Hummer, sitting in the middle of the goddamn intersection.
You swore big, Judy said. 2 quarters in the swear jar.
Thirst craned.
Are you sure?
Do you think anybody else in town has a vehicle that humongous?
Oh, Jesus,
Thurston said.
Swear jar.
This time Judy and Janny said it together. Linda felt her mouth dry up, and her tongue stuck to the roof of her mouth. Thibodeau was emerging from the Hummer's passenger side, and if he looked this way... If he sees us, I'm going to run him down, she thought. The idea brought a certain perverse calm. Thibodeau opened the back door of the Hummer. Peter Randolph got out.
That man is picking his seat, Alice Appleton informed the company at large. My mother says that means you're going to the movies.
Thurston Marshall burst out laughing, and Linda, who would have said she didn't have a laugh anywhere in her, joined him. Soon they were all laughing, even Aiden, who certainly didn't know what they were laughing about. Linda wasn't sure she did either.
Randolph headed down the hill on foot, still yanking at the seat of his uniform trousers. There was no reason for it to be funny, and that made it funnier. Not wanting to be left out, Audrey began to bark.
6. Somewhere a dog was barking. Big Jim heard it but didn't bother turning around. Watching Peter Randolph stride down the hill suffused him with well-being.
Look at him picking his pants out of his butt, Carter remarked. My father used to say that meant you were going to the movies.
The only place he's going is out to WCIK, Big Jim said, and if he's bullheaded about making a frontal assault, it's likely to be the last place he ever goes. Let's go down to the town hall and watch this carnival on TV for a while.
When that becomes tiresome, I want you to find the hippie doctor and tell him if he tries to scoot off somewhere, we'll run him down and throw him in jail.
Yes, sir.
This was duty he didn't mind. Maybe he could take another run at ex-officer Everett, this time get her pants off. Big Jim put the Hummer in gear and rolled slowly down the hill, honking at people who didn't get out of his way quickly enough. As soon as he had turned into the town hall driveway, the Odyssey van rolled through the intersection and headed out of town. There was no foot traffic on Upper Highland Street, and Linda accelerated rapidly. Thurst Marshall began singing The Wheels on the Bus, and soon all the kids were singing with him. Linda, who felt a little more terror leave her with each tenth of a mile the odometer turned, soon began to sing along. 7. Visitor's Day has come to Chester's Mill, and a mood of eager anticipation fills the people walking out Route 119 toward the Dinsmore Farm, where Joe McClatchy's demonstration went so wrong just 5 days ago. They are hopeful, if not exactly happy, in spite of that memory, also in spite of the heat and smelly air. The horizon beyond the dome now appears blurred, and above the trees the sky has darkened due to accumulated particulate matter. It's better when you look straight up, but still not right. The blue has a yellowish cast, like a film of cataract on an old man's eye.
It's how the sky used to look over the paper mills back in the 70s when they were running full blast, says Henrietta Clabbard, she of the not-quite-broken ass.
She offers her bottle of ginger ale to Petra Searles, who's walking beside her.
No, thank you, Petra says. I have some water.
Is it spiked with vodka? Henrietta inquires. Because this is half and half, sweetheart. I call it a Canada Dry Rocket.
Petra takes the bottle and downs a healthy slug.
Yow, she says.
Henrietta nods in businesslike fashion.
Yes, ma'am. It's not fancy, but it does brighten up a person's day.
Many of the pilgrims are carrying signs they plan on flashing to their visitors from the outside world, and to the cameras, of course, like the audience at a live network morning show. But network morning show signs are uniformly cheerful. Most of these are not. Some, left over from the previous Sunday's demo, read, Fight the Power, and Let Us Out, Damn It. There are new ones that say, Government Experiment, Why? And The Cover-Up, and We're Human Beings, Not Guinea Pigs. Johnny Carver's reads, Stop Whatever You're Doing in the Name of God Before It's Too Late. Frieda Morrison's asks, ungrammatically but passionately, Whose crimes are we dying for? Bruce Yardley's is the only one to strike a completely positive note. Attached to a 7-foot stick and wrapped in blue crepe paper, at the dome it will tower over all the others, it reads, Hello, Mom and Dad in Cleveland. Love you guys. 9 or 10 signs feature scriptural references. Bonnie Morell, wife of the town's lumberyard owner, carries one that proclaims, "Don't forgive them because they do know what they do." Trina Cales says, "The Lord is my shepherd," below a drawing of what is probably a sheep, although it's tough to be sure. Donnie Barabo simply reads, "Pray for us." Marta Edmonds, who sometimes babysits for the Everetts, isn't among the pilgrims. Her ex-husband lives in South Portland, but she doubts if he'll show up, and what would she say if he did? "You're behind on the alimony, cocksucker?" She goes out Little Bitch Road instead of down Route 119. The advantage is that she doesn't have to walk. She takes her Acura and runs the air conditioning full blast. Her destination is the cozy little house where Clayton Brassey has spent his declining years. He is her great-great-uncle once removed, or some damn thing. And while she isn't quite sure of either their kinship or degree of separation, she knows he has a generator. If it's still working, she can watch on TV. She also wants to assure herself that Uncle Clayton's still okay as it's possible to be when you're 105 and your brains have turned to Quaker oatmeal. He is not okay. Clayton Brassey has given up the mantle of oldest living town resident. He's sitting in the living room in his favorite chair with his chipped enamel urinal in his lap and the Boston Post cane leaning against the wall nearby, and he's cold as a cracker. There's no sign of Nell Toomey, his great-great-granddaughter and chief caregiver. She's gone out to the dome with her brother and sister-in-law. Marta says, "Oh, Unc, I'm sorry, but probably it was time." She goes into the bedroom, gets a fresh sheet from the closet, and tosses it over the old man. The result makes him look a bit like a covered piece of furniture in an abandoned house. A high boy, perhaps. Marta can hear the Jenny putting away out back and thinks, "What the hell?" She turns on the TV, tunes it to CNN, and sits on the couch. What's unfolding on screen almost makes her forget she's keeping company with a corpse. It's an aerial shot taken with a powerful distance lens from a helicopter hovering above the Motton Flea Market where the visitors' buses will park. The early starters inside the dome have already arrived. Behind them comes the Hodge, two-lane blacktop filled from side to side and stretching all the way back to Food City. The similarity of the town citizens to trekking ants is unmistakable. Some newscasters babbling away using words like wonderful and amazing. The second time he says, "I have never seen anything like this," Marta mutes the sound, thinking, "Nobody has, you dummox." She's thinking about getting up and seeing what there might be in the kitchen to snack on. Maybe that's wrong with a corpse in the room, but she's hungry, damn it. When the picture goes to a split screen, on the left half, another helicopter is now tracking the line of buses heading out of Castle Rock, and the super at the bottom of the screen reads, "Visitors to arrive shortly after 10 a.m. There's time to fix a little something after all. Marta finds crackers, peanut butter, and, best of all, 3 cold bottles of Bud. She takes everything back into the living room on a tray and settles in. "Thanks, Unc," she says. Even with the sound off, especially with the sound off, the juxtaposed images are riveting, hypnotic. As the first beer hits her, joyously, Marta realizes it's like waiting for an irresistible force to meet an immovable object and wondering if there will be an explosion when they come together. Not far from the gathering crowd on the knoll where he has been digging his father's grave, Ollie Dinsmore leans on his spade and watches the crowd arrive. 200, then 4, then 8, 800 at least. He sees a woman with a baby on her back in one of those papoose carriers and wonders if she's insane, bringing a kid that small out in this heat, without even a hat to protect its head. The arriving townsfolk stand in the hazy sun watching and waiting anxiously for the buses. Ollie thinks what a slow, sad walk they are going to have once the hoopla's over, all the way back to town in the simmering late afternoon heat. Then he turns once more to the job at hand. Behind the growing crowd on both shoulders of 119, the police, a dozen mostly new officers led by Henry Morrison, park with their flashers throbbing. The last 2 police cars are late arriving because Henry ordered them to fill their trunks with containers of water from the spigot at the fire department, where, he has discovered, the generator is not only working, but looks good to go for another couple of weeks. There's nowhere near enough water, a foolishly meager amount, in fact, given the size of the crowd, but it's the best they can do. They'll save it for the folks who faint in the sun. Henry hopes there won't be many, but he knows there will be some. and he curses Jim Rennie for the lack of preparation. He knows it's because Rennie doesn't give a damn. And to Henry's mind, that makes the negligence worse. He has ridden out with Pamela Chen, the only one of the new special deputies he completely trusts. And when he sees the size of the crowd, he tells her to call the hospital. He wants the ambulance out here standing by. She comes back 5 minutes later with news Henry finds both incredible and completely unsurprising. One of the patients answered the phone at reception, Pamela says. A young woman who came in early this morning with a broken wrist. She says all the medical personnel is gone, and the ambulance is gone too.
Well, that's just great, Henry says. I hope your first aid skills are up to snuff, Pammy, because you may have to use them.
I can give CPR, she says.
Good.
He points to Joe Boxer, the ego-loving dentist. Boxer is wearing a blue armband and self-importantly waving people to either side of the road. Most pay no attention.
And if someone gets a toothache, that self-important prick can pull it for them.
If they've got the cash to pay, Pamela says. She has had experience of Joe Boxer when her wisdom teeth came in. He said something about trading one service for another while eyeing her breasts in a way she didn't care for at all.
I think there's a Red Sox hat in the back of my car, Henry says. If so, would you take it over there?
He points to the woman Ollie has already noticed, the one with the bareheaded baby.
Put it on the kid and tell that woman she's an idiot.
I'll take the hat, but I won't tell her any such thing, Pamela says quietly. That's Mary Lou Costas. She's 17. She's been married for a year to a trucker who's almost twice her age, and she's probably hoping he comes to see her.
Henry sighs. She's still an idiot, but I guess at 17 we all are.
And still they come. One man appears to have no water, but he is carrying a large boombox that's blaring WCIK gospel. Two of his friends are unfurling a banner. The words on it are flanked by gigantic, clumsily drawn Q-tips. Please rescue us, the sign reads.
This is going to be bad,
Henry says. And of course he is right, but he has no idea how bad. The growing crowd waits in the sun. The ones with weak bladders wander into the underbrush west of the road to pee. Most get scratched up before finding relief. One overweight woman, Mabel Alston, she also suffers from what she calls the diabetes, sprains her ankle and lies there hollering until a couple of men come over and get her on her remaining good foot. Lenny Meacham, the town postmaster, at least until this week when delivery of the U.S. mail was canceled for the foreseeable future, borrows a cane for her. Then he tells Henry that Mabel needs a ride back to town. Henry says he can't spare a car. She'll have to rest in the shade, he says. Lenny waves his arms at both sides of the road.
In case you didn't notice, it's cow pasture on one side and brambles on the other. No shade to speak of.
Henry points to the Dinsmore Dairy Barn.
Plenty of shade there.
It's a quarter mile away, Lenny says indignantly.
It's an eighth of a mile at most, but Henry doesn't argue.
Put her in the front seat of my car.
Awful hot in the sun, Lenny says. She'll need the factory air.
Yes, Henry knows she'll need the air conditioning, which means running the motor, which means burning gasoline. There's no shortage of that right now. Assuming they can pump it out of the tanks at the gas and grocery, that is. And he supposes they'll have to worry about later.
Keys in the ignition, he says. Turn it to low cool. Do you understand?
Lenny says he does and heads back to Mabel. But Mabel's not ready to move. Although sweat is pouring down her cheeks and her face is bright red.
I didn't go yet, she bawls. I got to go.
Leo Lemoyne, one of the new officers, strolls up to Henry. This is company Henry could do without. Leo has the brain of a turnip.
How'd she get out here, sport? He asks.
Leo Lemoyne is the kind of man who calls everyone sport.
I don't know, but she did, Henry says wearily.
He's getting a headache.
Round up some women to take her behind my police car and hold her up while she piddles.
Which ones, sport?
Big ones, Henry says, and walks away before the sudden strong urge to punch Leo Lemoyne in the nose can overpower him.
What kind of police force is this?
a woman asks, as she and four others escort Mabel to the rear of Unit 3, where Mabel will pee while holding onto the bumper, the others standing in front of her for modesty's sake.
"Thanks to Rennie and Randolph, your fearless leader's the unprepared kind," Henry would like to reply, but he doesn't. He knows his mouth got him into trouble the night before, when he spoke in favor of Andrea Grinnell's being heard. What he says is, "The only one you've got."
To be fair, most people are, like Mabel's female honor guard, more than willing to help one another. Those who have remembered to bring water share it with those who did not, and most drink sparingly. There are idiots in every crowd, though, and those in this one pig the water freely and without thought. Some folks munch cookies and crackers that will leave them thirstier later on. Mary Lou Costas's baby begins to cry fretfully beneath the Red Sox cap, which is much too big for her. Mary Lou has brought a bottle of water, and she now begins to dab the baby's overheated cheeks and neck with it. Soon the bottle will be empty. Henry grabs Pamela Chen and again points to Mary Lou.
"Take that bottle and fill it from what we brought," he says. "Try not to let too many people see you, or it'll all be gone before noon."
She does as told, and Henry thinks, there's one at least who might actually make a good small-town cop, if she ever wanted the job. Nobody bothers to watch where Pamela is going. That's good. When the buses come, these folks will forget all about being hot and thirsty for a while. Of course, after the visitors go, and with a long walk back to town staring them in the face, an idea hits him. Henry scopes out his officers and sees a lot of dumbbells, but few people he trusts. Randolph has taken most of the halfway decent ones on some sort of secret mission. Henry thinks it has to do with the drug operation Andrea accused Rennie of running, but he doesn't care what it is. All he knows is that they aren't here, and he can't run this errand himself. But he knows who could, and hails him over.
"What do you want, Henry?"
Bill Allnut asks.
"Have you got your keys to the school?"
Allnut, who's been the middle school janitor for 30 years, nods.
"Right here."
The key ring hanging from his belt glitters in the hazy sun.
"Always carry him. Why?"
"Take Unit 4, Henry says. "Go back to town as fast as you can without running over any latecomers. Get one of the school buses and bring it out here. One of the 44-seaters.
Allnut doesn't look pleased. His jaw sets in a Yankee way Henry, a Yankee himself, has seen all his life, knows well, and hates. It's a penurious look that says, "I gotta take care of myself, chummy."
"You can't get all these people in one school bus, are you nuts?"
"Not all," Henry says. "Just the ones who won't be able to make it back on their own." He's thinking of Mabel and the Corso girl's overheated baby. But of course, by 3 this afternoon, there will be more who can't walk all the way back to town. Or maybe at all. Bill Allnut's jaw sets even more firmly. Now his chin is sticking out like the prow of a ship.
"Nah, sir. My 2 sons and their wives are coming. They said so. They're bringing their kids. I don't want to miss them, and I ain't leaving my wife. She's all upset."
Henry would like to shake the man for his stupidity and outright throttle him for his selfishness. Instead, he demands Allnut's keys and asks to be shown which one opens the motor pool. Then he tells Allnut to go back to his wife.
"I'm sorry, Henry," Allnut says, "but I got to see my kids and the grandkids. I deserve to. I didn't ask the lame, the halt, and the blind to come out here, and I shouldn't have to pay for their stupidity."
"Ah, yep. You're a fine American, no question about that," Henry says. "Get out of my sight."
Allnut opens his mouth to protest, thinks better of it. Perhaps it's something he sees on Officer Morrison's face, and shuffles away. Henry yells for Pamela, who does not protest when told she's to go back to town, only asks where, what, and why. Henry tells her,
"Okay, but are those school buses standard shift, because I can't drive a standard?"
Henry shouts the question to Allnut, who is standing at the dome with his wife Sarah, both of them eagerly scanning the empty highway on the other side of the Motton town line.
"Number 16 is a standard,"
Allnut shouts back.
"All the rest are automatics. And tell her to mind the interlock. Them buses won't start unless the driver fastens his seat belt."
Henry sends Pamela on her way, telling her to hurry as much as prudence will allow. He wants that bus, ASAP. At first, the people at the dome stand, anxiously watching the empty road. Then most of them sit down. Those who have brought blankets spread them. Some shade their heads from the hazy sun with their signs.
Conversation lags. And Wendy Goldstone can be heard quite clearly when she asks her friend Ellen where the crickets are. There's no singing in the high grass.
Or have I gone deaf?
She asks. She hasn't. The crickets are either silent or dead. In the WCIK studio, the airy and comfortably cool center space resounds to the voice of Ernie the Barrel Kellogg and his Delight Trio rocking out on "I Got a Telephone Call from Heaven, and it was Jesus on the Line." The two men aren't listening. They're watching the TV, as transfixed by the split-screen images as Marta Edmonds, who's on her second bud and has forgotten all about the corpse of old Clayton Brassey under the sheet. As transfixed as everyone in America and, yes, the world beyond.
"Look at them, Sanders,"
Chef breathes.
"I am,"
Andy says. He's got Claudette on his lap. Chef has offered him a couple of hand grenades as well, but this time Andy has declined. He's afraid he might pull the pin on one and then freeze. He saw that in a movie once.
"It's amazing. But don't you think we better get ready for our company?"
Chef knows Andy's right. But it's hard to look away from the side of the screen where the copter is tracking the buses and the large video truck that leads the parade. He knows every landmark they're passing. They are recognizable even from above. The visitors are getting close now. We're all getting close now, he thinks.
Sanders?
What, Chef?
Chef hands him a Sucrets tin.
The rock will not hide them. The dead tree gives no shelter nor the cricket relief. Just which book that's in slips my mind.
Andy opens the tin, sees six fat home-rolled cigarettes crammed in there, and thinks, these are soldiers of ecstasy. It is the most poetic thought of his life and makes him feel like weeping.
Can you give me an amen, Sanders?
Amen.
The chef uses the remote control to turn off the TV. He'd like to see the buses arrive. Stoned or not, paranoid or not, he's as fond of a happy reunion story as anyone. But the bitter men might come at any time.
Sanders?
Yes, Chef?
I'm going to get the Christian Meals on Wheels truck out of the garage and park it on the far side of the supply building. I can settle in behind it and have a clear view of the woods.
He picks up God's Warrior, the grenades attached to it dangle and swing.
The more I think of it, the more sure I am that's the way they'll come. There's an access road. They probably think I don't know about it, but
Chef's red eyes gleam.
The chef knows more than people think.
I know. I love you, Chef.
Thank you, Sanders. I love you, too. If they come from the woods, I'll let them get out in the open and then cut them down like wheat at harvest time. But we can't put all our eggs in one basket, so I want you to go out front to where we were the other day, if any of them come that way.
Andy raises Claudette.
That's right, Sanders, but don't be hasty. Draw out as many as you can before you start shooting.
I will.
Sometimes Andy is struck by the feeling that he must be living in a dream. This is one of those times.
Like wheat at harvest time.
Yea, verily. But listen, because this is important, Sanders. Don't come right away if you hear me start shooting. And I won't come right away if I hear you start. They might guess we're not together, but I'm wise to that trick. Can you whistle?
Andy sticks a couple of fingers in his mouth and lets loose a piercing whistle.
That's good, Sanders. Amazing, in fact.
I learned it in grammar school.
When life was much simpler, he does not add.
Don't do it unless you're in danger of being overwhelmed, then I'll come. And if you hear me whistle, run like hell to reinforce my position.
Okay.
Let's have a smoke on it, Sanders. What do you say?
Andy seconds the motion. On Black Ridge at the edge of the McCoy Orchard, 17 exiles from town stand against the smudged skyline like Indians in a John Ford Western. Most are staring in fascinated silence at the silent parade of people moving out Route 119. They are almost 6 miles distant, but the size of the crowd makes it impossible to miss. Rusty's the only one who's looking at something closer, and it fills him with a relief so great, it seems to sing. The Silver Odyssey van is speeding along Black Ridge Road. He stops breathing as it approaches the edge of the trees and the glow belt, which is now invisible again. There is time for him to think how horrible it would be if whoever is driving, Linda, he assumes, blacked out and the van crashed, but then it's past the danger point. There might have been the smallest swerve, but he knows even that could have been his imagination. They'll be here soon. They are standing 100 yards to the left of the box, but Joe McClatchy thinks he can feel it just the same. A little pulse that digs at his brain each time the lavender light shines out. That might just be his mind playing tricks on him, but he doesn't think so. Barbie is standing next to him, with his arm around Mrs. Shumway. Joe taps him on the shoulder and says, "This feels bad, Mr. Barbara. All those people together. This feels awful." "Yes," Barbie says. "They're watching the Leatherheads. I can feel them." "So can I," Barbie says.
"Me too," Julia says, in a voice almost too low to hear.
In the conference room of the town hall, Big Jim and Carter Thibodeau watch silently as the split-screen image on the TV gives way to a shot at ground level. At first, the image is jerky, like video of an approaching tornado or the immediate aftermath of a car bombing. They see sky, gravel, and running feet. Someone mutters, "Come on, hurry up." Wolf Blitzer says,
"The pool coverage truck has arrived. They're obviously hurrying, but I'm sure that in a moment..." "Yes. Oh my goodness, look at that."
The camera steadies on the hundreds of Chester's Mill residents at the dome just as they rise to their feet. It's like watching a large group of open-air worshippers rising from prayer. The ones at the front are being jostled against the dome by the ones behind. Big Jim sees flattened noses, cheeks, and lips, as if the townspeople are being pressed against a glass wall. He feels a moment of vertigo and realizes why. This is the first time he's seeing from the outside. For the first time, the enormity of it and the reality of it strike home. For the first time, he is truly frightened. Faintly, slightly deadened by the dome, comes the sound of pistol shots.
"I think I'm hearing gunfire," Wolf says. "Anderson Cooper, do you hear gunfire? What's happening?"
Faintly, sounding like a call from a satellite phone originating deep in the Australian outback, Cooper comes back.
"Wolf, we're not there yet, but I've got a small monitor, and it looks like..." "I see it now," Wolf says. "It appears to be..."
"It's Morrison," Carter says. "The guy's got guts, I'll say that much."
"He's out, as of tomorrow," Big Jim replies.
Carter looks at him, eyebrows raised.
"What he said at the meeting last night?"
Big Jim points a finger at him.
"I knew you were a bright boy."
At the dome, Henry Morrison isn't thinking about last night's meeting or bravery or even doing his duty. He's thinking that people are going to be crushed against the dome if he doesn't do something and quick. So he fires his gun into the air. Taking the cue, several other cops, Todd Wendelstedt, Rance Conroy, and Joe Boxer, do the same. The shouting voices and the cries of pain from the people at the front who are being squashed give way to shock silence, and Henry uses his bullhorn.
"Spread out! Spread out, goddammit! There's room for everyone if you just spread the fuck out!"
The profanity has an even more sobering effect on them than the gunshots, and although the most stubborn ones remain on the highway, Bill and Sarah Allnut are prominent among them, so are Johnny and Carrie Carver, the others begin to spread along the dome. Some head to the right, but the majority shuffle to the left, into Alden Dinsmore's field, where the going's easier. Henrietta and Petra are among them, weaving slightly from liberal applications of Canada Dry Rocket. Henry holsters his weapon and tells the other officers to do the same. Wendelstedt and Conroy comply, but Joe Boxer continues to hold his snub-nosed .38, a Saturday night special if Henry has ever seen one.
"Make me,"
he sneers. And Henry thinks, it's all a nightmare. I'll wake up soon in my own bed and I'll go to the window and stand there looking out at a beautiful, crisp fall day. Many of those who have chosen to stay away from the dome, a disquieting number have remained in town because they're beginning to experience respiratory problems, are able to watch on television. 30 or 40 have gravitated to Dippers. Tommy and Willow Anderson are at the dome, but they've left the roadhouse open and the big screen TV on. The people who gather on the honky-tonk hardwood floor to watch do so quietly, although there is some weeping. The HDTV images are crystal clear. They are heartbreaking. Nor are they the only ones who are affected by the sight of 800 people lining up along the invisible barrier, some with their hands planted on what appears to be thin air. Wolf Blitzer says, "I have never seen such longing on human faces. I..." He chokes up. "I think I better let the images speak for themselves." He falls silent. And that's a good thing. This scene needs no narration. At his press conference, Cox said, "Visitors will debark and walk. Visitors will be allowed within 2 yards of the dome. We consider that a safe distance." Nothing like that happens, of course. As soon as the doors of the buses open, people spill out in a flood, calling the names of their nearest and dearest. Some fall and are briskly trampled. One will be killed in this stampede, and 14 will be injured, half a dozen seriously. Soldiers who attempt to enforce the dead zone directly in front of the dome are swept aside. The yellow "Do Not Cross" tapes are knocked down and disappear in the dust raised by running feet. The newcomers swarm forward and spread out on their side of the dome, most crying, and all of them calling for their wives, their husbands, their grandparents, their sons, their daughters, their fiancés. 4 people have either lied about their various electronic medical devices or forgotten about them. 3 of these die immediately. The 4th, who didn't see his battery-powered hearing aid implant on the list of forbidden devices, will linger in a coma for a week before expiring of multiple brain hemorrhages. Little by little, they sort themselves out, and the pool TV cameras see it all. They observe the townspeople and the visitors pressing their hands together, with the invisible barrier between. They watch them try to kiss. They examine men and women weeping as they look into each other's eyes. They note the ones who faint, both inside the dome and out, and those who fall to their knees and pray, facing each other with their folded hands raised. They record the man on the outside, who begins hammering his fists against the thing keeping him from his pregnant wife, hammering until his skin splits and his blood beads on thin air. They peer at the old woman trying to trace her fingers, the tips pressed white and smooth against the unseen surface between them, over her sobbing granddaughter's forehead. The press helicopter takes off again and hovers, sending back images of a double human snake spread over a quarter of a mile. On the Motton side, the leaves flame and dance with late October color. On the Chester's Mill side, they hang limp. Behind the townsfolk, on the road, in the fields, caught in the bushes, are dozens of discarded signs. At this moment of reunion, or almost reunion, politics and protest have been forgotten. Candy Crowley says, "Wolf, this is without a doubt the saddest, strangest event I've witnessed in all my years of reporting. Yet human beings are nothing if not adaptable." And little by little, the excitement and the strangeness begin to wear off. The reunions merge into the actual visiting. And behind the visitors, those who have been overwhelmed on both sides of the dome are being carried away. On the mill side, there's no Red Cross tent to drag them to. The police put them in such scant shade as the police cars allow to wait for Pamela Chen and the school bus. In the police station, the WCIK raiding party is watching with the same silent fascination as everyone else. Randolph lets them. There is a little time yet. He checks the names off on his clipboard, then motions Freddie Denton to join him on the front steps. He has expected grief from Freddie for taking over the head honcho role. Peter Randolph has been judging others by himself his whole life. But there is none. This is a far bigger deal than rousting scuzzy old drunks out of convenience stores. And Freddie is delighted to hand off the responsibility. He wouldn't mind taking credit if things went well, but suppose they don't. Randolph has no such qualms. One unemployed troublemaker and a mild-mannered druggist who wouldn't say shit if it was in his cereal? What can possibly go wrong? And Freddie discovers as they stand on the steps Piper Libby tumbled down not so long ago that he isn't going to be able to duck the leadership role completely. Randolph hands him a slip of paper. On it are 7 names. 1 is Freddie's. The other 6 are Mel Searles, George Frederick, Marty Arsenault, Aubrey Toll, Stubby Norman, and Lauren Connery. "You will take this party down the access road," Randolph says. "You know the one?"
Yep. Busts off from little bitch this side of town. Slappy Sam's father laid that little piece of rogue.
I don't care who laid it, Randolph says. Just drive to the end of it. At noon, you take your men through the belt of woods there. You'll come out in back of the radio station. Noon, Freddy. That doesn't mean a minute before or a minute after.
I thought we were all supposed to go in that way, Pete.
Plans have changed.
Does Big Jim know they've changed?
Big Jim is a selectman, Freddy. I'm the police chief. I'm also your superior, so would you kindly shut up and listen?
Sorry, Freddy says, and cups his hands to his ears in a way that is impudent, to say the least.
I'll be parked down the road that runs past the front of the station. I'll have Stewart and Fern with me. Also Roger Killian. If Bushy and Sanders are foolish enough to engage you, if we hear shooting from behind the station, in other words, the three of us will swoop in and take them from behind. Have you got it?
Yeah.
It actually sounds like a pretty good plan to Freddy. All right, let's synchronize watches.
Sorry?
Randolph sighs. We have to make sure they're the same, so noon comes at the same time for both of us.
Freddy still looks puzzled, but he complies.
From inside the station, someone, it sounds like Stubby, shouts,
Hope, another one bites the dust. The Fainters are stacked up behind them cruisers like cordwood.
This is greeted by laughter and applause. They are pumped up, excited to have pulled what Melvin Searles calls possible shooting duty. We saddle up at 11:15, Randolph tells Freddy. That gives us almost 45 minutes to watch the show on TV.
Want popcorn? Freddy asks. We got a whole mess of it in the cupboard over the microwave.
Might as well, I guess.
Out at the dome, Henry Morrison goes to his car and helps himself to a cool drink. His uniform is soaked through with sweat, and he can't recall ever feeling so tired. He thinks a lot of that is down to bad air. He can't seem to completely catch his breath. But on the whole, he is satisfied with himself and his men. They have managed to avoid a mass crushing at the dome. Nobody has died on this side, yet, and folks are settling down. Half a dozen TV cameramen race to and fro on the Mountain side, recording as many heartwarming reunion vignettes as possible. Henry knows it's an invasion of privacy, but he supposes America and the world beyond may have a right to see this. And on the whole, people don't seem to mind. Some even like it. They are getting their 15 minutes. Henry has time to search for his own mother and father, although he's not surprised when he doesn't see them. They live all the way to hell and gone up in Derry, and they're getting on in years now. He doubts if they even put their names in the visitor lottery.
A new helicopter is beating in from the west, and although Henry doesn't know it, Colonel James Cox is inside. Cox is also not entirely displeased with the way Visitor's Day has gone so far. He has been told no one on the Chester's Mill side seems to be preparing for a press conference, but this doesn't surprise or discommode him. Based on the extensive files he has been accumulating, he would have been more surprised if Rennie had put in an appearance. Cox has saluted a lot of men over the years, and he can smell a bully pulpit coward a mile away. Then Cox sees the long line of visitors and the trapped townspeople facing them. The sight drives James Rennie from his mind.
Isn't that the damnedest thing? He murmurs. Isn't that just the damnedest thing anyone ever saw?
On the dome side, Special Deputy Toby Manning shouts,
Here comes the bus!
Although the civilians barely notice, they are either raptly engaged with their relatives or still searching for them. The cops raise a cheer. Henry walks to the back of his cruiser, and sure enough, a big yellow school bus is just passing Jim Rennie's used cars. Pamela Chen may not weigh more than 105 pounds soaking wet, but she's come through big time, and with a big bus. Henry checks his watch and sees that it's 20 minutes past 11. We're going to get through this, he thinks. We're going to get through this just fine. On Main Street, three big orange trucks are rolling uptown Common Hill. In the third one, Peter Randolph is crammed in with Stu, Fern, and Roger, redolent of chickens. As they head out 119 northbound toward Little Bitch Road and the radio station, Randolph is struck by a thought and barely restrains himself from smacking his palm against his forehead. They have plenty of firepower, but they have forgotten the helmets and Kevlar vests. Go back and get them? If they do that,
They won't be in position until 12:15, maybe even later. And the vests would almost certainly turn out to be a needless precaution anyway. It's 11 against